Okay. Welcome to your Yom Iyun on issues of Shemitah. I know you've already had one short session, which I hope set you up for the day. I'm here to talk to you for about an hour. I need to go at 10:20 pretty promptly. My topic is the historical controversies of Shemitah. I'm not sure if you say controversies or controversies. You can pick whichever one you feel like. In England, I'm not sure what we say either now. I've been here so long, I can't remember what the different pronunciations are. But one way or the other, there's a lot of historical stuff to talk about. And I want to first introduce you to two books, which I strongly recommend, both of them for different aspects of Shemitah. It's Shemitah for another year and a half, or 2 years. You might think this year is just Shemitah. The answer is it's not really, because this year already is Shemitah, but next year a lot of the issues to do with Shemitah still very much apply, certainly with to do with fruits, and as things become preserved and tinned and things like that, canned fruits, you end up with a long-term Shemitah implications going forward into the next few years, and therefore you've plenty of time to read both of these books. The first book I'd recommend is this book here, which is in Hebrew and in English. This one is the English version. This was brought out first 7 years ago. This is Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon's book called Shemitah. Okay? This is a revised edition brought out for this Shemitah year, which is really, really excellent. He has got lots of very interesting observations, halachic, hashkafic, charts, pictures. Very, very practical, very, very helpful. Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon is one of the leading halakhic authorities in the religious Zionist community. He lives in Alon Shvut. He's the Rav of the Yishuv there, and he's become really quite well known across the world as a major halakhic figure, and certainly on Shemitah he has a lot of interesting things to say. Obviously he has a perspective. Everybody has a perspective on this issue. One of the things that we'll learn about today is that there is no safe option for Shemitah. Everyone treats likes to pretend that there is, and that their approach to Shemitah is the machmir approach or the strict approach. Actually, there is no such thing as a strict approach to Shemitah, because pretty much whichever direction you decide to be strict in involves some compromise in another direction, which people usually downplay because they don't want to talk about that. So there is, I think it's very important to say, no safe option, and everybody has their own perspective, and I don't know about agenda. Agenda's perhaps a bit strong, but Rav Rimon certainly is coming at it from a religious Zionist perspective, but the halacha is very, very helpful, and I strongly recommend the book. The second book I recommend, which is a completely different kind of book, is this book, which I came across quite by accident about 6 months ago, called Rebels in the Holy Land. It is a historical book by a fellow called Sam Finkel about the early Yishuvim in Eretz Yisrael, in the new Yishuv, in the 1880s, particularly Maskeret Batya, or Ekron, as it was called. And it's a fantastic book with loads of historical documents, charts, pictures of different things, of people, of newspapers. And it really talks about the first Shemitah year. What's that? Yeah, of course you can. Just be careful with it because it's falling apart a little bit. It talks about the first Shemitah year that everything really blew up in 1888, which we'll talk about in a minute. And it goes through the developments of how that happened. And again, very strongly recommend the book. It's a real page turner. And if you take it away with you for the weekend, I'm sure you'll really enjoy it. So that's the second book I recommend. What I'd like to do with you this morning is the following. Mostly it's going to be talking about the history. But I'd like to start off with a little bit of halachic background to give you really the basis for what we're talking about. Shemitah is a complex topic, but don't get scared by it, because it's not that complex. If you can keep Shabbat, you can keep Shemitah. Shabbat is infinitely more complex than Shemitah, and therefore don't be frightened into, this is part of the scare tactic, by the way, of Shemitah, that people get scared or off by it. I just want to avoid the whole problem. Avoiding the whole problem is A, not necessary, because if you're intelligent, which you all are, you can quickly get your head around it and work out how to navigate it. And secondly, it's not advisable. It's a little bit like, if I may bring an analogy, it's a little bit like saying Shabbat's incredibly complicated. If I get it wrong, it's Chayav Kares, which you will see the Shemitah is far from that. But Shabbat's very complicated, so can you just put me into some kind of deep sleep on Friday afternoon and wake me up on lots of Shabbos? Therefore, there's no chance that I'll ever do anything wrong on Shabbos. So, okay, that's the strategy. You could do that. You'll never break Shabbos if someone puts you to sleep on Friday afternoon and wakes you up on Motzei Shabbos. True. But you'll never keep Shabbos either. And you'll never experience Shabbos. And therefore, taking that approach to Shemitah, which I think some people, and maybe even some communities, do, which is basically, get me out of the problem, let's just pretend it's not Shemitah, and wake me up again when Shemitah's over, does avoid some of the problems, but it also avoids the opportunities which I think Shemitah presents. And we'll talk a little bit about that as well. Let's talk about some halacha first, to give us a taste of Torah, before we get into all the historical stuff. First of all, if we're talking historically, let's go back to the very beginning. When did Shemitah start? And the answer is, when they came into Eretz Israel, I brought you four psukim, 1, 2, 3, and 4, which set the scene for Shemitah. First of all, look at number 1, Daber al Bnei Israel, says God to Moshe, tell the Jewish people, V'amata elehem ki tavo el ha'aretz, when you get to the land, asher ani noisin lachem, v'shafta ha'aretz shabbat lachem. The land will rest a Shabbat for God. So clearly Shemitah doesn't start until they get into Eretz Israel. But not only that, it only starts when they conquer Eretz Israel. Look at number 2. Says the Pasuk later on, Kol amokam asher tidroich kaf raglechem, all the place that your feet will tread, bo lachem yiyeh min ha-midbar ha-lebanon, that's going to be for you from the northern Lebanon, from the Lebanon, etc., min ha-nahar and ha-prat, from the river Prat, ad yam acharon, until the Mediterranean, yiyeh gvulchem, that will be your boundary, but it has to be the place where your feet have actually trodden, meaning, it's not going to be Eretz Israel until they've actually conquered the land. And not only conquered the land, they also had to divide up the land. Look at number 3, which is back to Shemitah again. Sheshanim tizra sadcha, sadecha, excuse me. 6 years you will sow your field, sadecha, your field. Vesheshanim tizmor karmecha, and 6 years you will prune your vineyard. It has to be yours. Shabbos la'ashem sadcha, etc. It has to be your field and your vineyard. Meaning, until they both conquered and owned the land, there was no Shemitah. And therefore, if you look for a second in number 5, we'll go back to number 4 in a moment, the first thing to understand about Shemitah, the Rambam, I'm going to bring you a few Rambams here, says, Me'emasai hitchilu limnos. When did they start to count the Shemitah cycle? Ma'acha arba esrei shanan shenichnusu la'aretz. 14 years after they came into the land. Shine'emar, it says, Sheshanim tizrasadecho, you will plant for 6 years, etc. Actually, kol echad makir et arzai, until each individual farmer in Israel had his own plot, okay, and recognized his own plot. V'shevashanim asu b'kibush, 7 years they conquered the land, ha'aretz. V'shevashanim b'chiluk, and 7 years they distributed the land. Umanu sheva shmitois, and then from that 14th year, they then counted 7 shmitas. And the 50th year was then the Yovel, which we'll talk about in a second. So the Shemitah cycle historically in Israel only started 14 years after they came in, and then they started counting the Shemitahs. 7 cycles of Shemitah, then Yovel is the 50th year, then 7 cycles of Shemitah, then Yovel is the 50th year. Fine. Historically, therefore, in the first temple period, they had Shemitah in full force, from when they came, even before the first temple period, from when they came into the land, conquered the land, distributed the land, Shemitah, there it goes. Now, I mentioned Yovel. Shemitah and Yovel are interlinked. Yovel is the 50th year after 7 cycles of Shemitah. It's like a jumbo Shemitah year where you have the 49th and the 50th together. So if you look in Pasuk number 4, it says there with Shemitah, Usparta lecha sheva shabbatos, you will count 7 cycles. Sheva tabashos shanim, 7 cycles of years. Sheva shanim, sheva parmin. 7 years, 7 times. V'hayu l'cha yinei sheva shabbatos shanim, teisheva arba shana. And you'll get 49 years. Then, v'kidashtim eshnat ha-chamishim. You'll sanctify the 50th year. V'karata drova aretz. And you will cry freedom in the land. V'chol yoshver to all of its residents. And that will be the Yovel year. From here you see that Shemitah and Yovel are interlinked. They are intertwined. And from that comes the Gemara and says that unless there is a Yovel, there isn't really a Shemitah either. Meaning you can't have one without the other. You can't have Yovel without Shemitah, and by the same token, you can't have Shemitah without Yovel. Look at the Gemara number 6. Detanya, Mishigalu Shevet Reuben. The Gemara says, once the tribe of Reuben, the Shevet Gad, and the tribe of Gad, the Shevet Manasseh, and half the tribe of Manasseh were exiled. They were the ones living in Transjordan. They were the ones that went first, even before the 10 tribes were exiled from the northern kingdom. Once they went, Batlu Yovelus. Then there's no more Yovel. Why? Because the Pasuk for Yovel said, Kol Yoshveha. Yovel only applies when everybody's there. Now, kol doesn't mean every single Jew, meaning the minute one Jew pops out of Eretz Yisrael on business in the first temple period, the whole of the Shemitah Yovel system falls apart. No. It means that all of the tribes have to be there, presumably the majority of all of the tribes. And then he goes on to say, Shnei Emar v'karasim dro ba'aretz v'kol yoshveha. Bizman shekol yoshveha aleha, in the time when all the Jewish people are on it, the loy bizman shegol amiktasim, but not when part of them have been exiled. Says the Gemara, Yochel hayu aleha v'heim u'rabim. Maybe you could have a situation where all the Jewish people are there, but they're just mixed up. They're not living in the correct places anymore. Shevet Binyamin b'Yehuda, the tribe of Binyamin is in Yehuda. Shevet Yehuda b'Binyamin, and Yehuda is in Binyamin. Yehei Yovel, no, maybe there'll still be a Yovel. Talmud Lama, the Torah says, no, l'kol yoshveha, bizman sheyoshvim ketikunam. Only when they're living in the correct place, the loy bizman sheheim u'rav, not when they're mixed up. So, what comes out from this is as follows. There is no Yovel anymore, because the Jewish people are not living in their tribes, in their correct places in Israel. Since there is no Yovel anymore, there is no Shemitah anymore. We will see in a minute. Now, what does that mean there's no Shemitah anymore? There is Shemitah. It's Shemitah year. So have a look at the Rambam here in straight away in, or the first of Gemara in number 8. I'm doing this quite quickly, but this is a background information that you need. So far we've seen that Yovel and Shemitah are somehow intertwined. And Yovel doesn't apply anymore. So says number 8, says the Gemara number 8 as follows. Now we're already after the second temple period. Okay, Yovel ceased to apply already during the first temple period. Now we're already, by the source number 8, into the quote-unquote modern period where there is no temple at all. So now, says the Mishnah, Mashkin beis hashlachim b'moyed u'b'shvit. It gives a heter, the Mishnah gives a heter, to water fields during Shemitah year. To water the fields. So the Gemara asks, Shviyas? Really? And during Chol HaMoed, but Chol HaMoed is a separate question. Shemitah year, really? You can water fields during Shemitah year? Shviyas bein lamanda ala mishum zoreya. Whether you say that the problem is zoreya, which is causing things to grow, which is not allowed, bein lamanda ala mishum chorish, whether you say plowing, preparing the land, which is also not allowed, zoreya v'charisha v'shviyas mishari, are you really allowed to water fields during Shemitah? How can it be saying in the Gemara, you're allowed to water the fields during Shemitah year for certain reasons? So the Gemara gives two answers, and this is important preparation now for what we're going to talk about, the historical controversies. Amar Abaya, Abaya says the following. B'shvit bizman azeh. Oh, we're talking about Shemitah these days. Abaya's already living after the second temple was destroyed. The Jews are in Galut. These days, he says, v'rebihi. It's the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi's opinion is that since there is no Yovel, which is because the tribes are not there anymore, and since Shemitah is connected with Yovel, today there is no Shemitah on a Torah level. What there is Shemitah on a rabbinic level. Meaning, the rabbis introduced a drabbanon level of Shemitah, so we wouldn't forget about Shemitah. But really, on a Torah level, there is no Shemitah anymore, because it's connected with Yovel. And then the Gemara gives a second answer. Rava Amar, Rava says no. Afilu Tamar Rabbanon, you can even follow the opinion of the Rabbanan, who says, no, Shemitah is still Doraisa, it's not connected with Yovel, unlike what we saw before. But Avos Osa Rachmana, and technically speaking, the sowing, watering the field is not a Doraisa Malacha, it's a Drabbanon Malacha. Meaning, when it comes to Hilcha Shemitah, even if you hold that Shemitah itself is Min HaTorah, there are different levels of Malacha, just like on Shabbat, there are Doraisas, there are Drabbanon. So this Gemara basically gives two approaches. Either Shemitah today is Rabbinic, that's why the whole thing is Rabbinic, that's why the rabbis are giving a heter to water the land, or Shemitah is Min HaTorah, but technically this particular thing they were giving a heter for is a rabbinic malacha. So which way do we paskin? And that's really the introductory question for the shir. Which way are we going to rule on this question? Is Shemitah Doraita or is Shemitah Drabbanon? Almost all of the Rishonim, and the Rambam really is what we're going to see now, rule that Shemitah is rabbinic today. And follow the opinion, based on this Gemara, that since Bizman Azeh, there is no Yovel, these days there is no Yovel, because the Jewish people are not living in all their tribes, and they're not in the land, and most of the Jewish people are not even in Israel, although it's not necessarily linked with the majority of the Jewish people, we'll see in a minute. Since there is no Yovel, there is no Shemitah Doraisa, there is only Shemitah Drabbanon. Have a look in number 9, for a second. In number 9, you'll see the Rambam in Hilchos Shemitah, where he says as follows. Ubizman ha-yovel noyeg, when there is Yovel, noheg din eved ivri, then there are various other dinim that apply, the Hebrew slave din applies, v'noheg et shvit, and shemitah applies, ba'aretz, in the land, the Hashmachas Ksofim, and the writing off of loans, Bechol Makom Min HaTorah. When there is Yovel, these things apply Min HaTorah. Ubizman She'ein a Yovel Noyeg. When there is no Yovel, now there's a slightly different wording here from the one you've got here, because I saw in another text in the Rambam, there's a slightly different wording. I'll give you the wording that I've changed. Ein a Noyeg Eved Ivri. So there is no Eved Ivri when there's no Yovel. Yovel, the noheged shviyit ba'aret midivreihem, and the Rambam says there is shmita, but shmita is midrabanan. So again, the Rambam seems pretty clearly to rule, although there is a little bit of discussion about the exact wording of the text of the Rambam, which I'm not getting into now. The Rambam seems very clearly to rule that shmita today is connected with yovel and therefore is only applicable on a rabbinic level. Secondly, he links it with truma as well, trumas and maestras. Today, do we have to take Trumot and Maestrot from produce in Eretz Yisrael? The answer is yes. But is that on a Torah or Rabbinic level? Now again, Trumot and Maestrot has got nothing to do with Yovel. They're not linked in the Pesukim at all. So you think, well, Trumot applies presumably on a Torah level. You know, we're in the land, it is Eretz Yisrael. Why not? Says the Rambam, not so quick. Have a look here in number 10. Chiyuv Eretz Ha'aretz B'Shvius, the obligation of the land of Israel in Shemitah, Uba Maisras, and now he connects with Maisras and with Maisa, Eina El Mitneshu Hu Kibush Rabim, was only because they conquered the land. We saw that at the beginning. The Kaven Shenilkechu Ha'aretz Miyadehim, but once they lost the land, once we were exiled to Babel, Batel HaKibush, then the conquest was lost, the Niftarim in HaTorah, and now it's exempt from on a Torah level, Mimasras, from Trubas and Maisras, Umishvias, and from Shvias. Shehari Einum in Eretz Israel, because now it's no longer the halachic Eretz Israel, because we lost the conquest, we were taken out. Now, secondly, the Kevan Sha'ala Ezra, once Ezra came up in the second temple time, the Kitcha, and he not conquered, because that's the whole point, he re-consecrated Eretz Israel. Remember, they went to Babel, and then they came back. He re-consecrated Eretz Israel. Okay? Loi Kitcha Bekibush, they never conquered it. How did the Jews get back into Eretz Israel after the Babylonian exile? They what's that? It wasn't the Romans, but someone let them in. Who let them in? Koresh. The Persians let them in. And then the Greeks let them live there. And then the Romans let them live there. There was a brief period of the Hashmonaim when they were independent, but pretty much the whole Second Temple period, the Jews were there because they were allowed by the non-Jewish empires to be there. There was no Jewish conquest of the land. Says the Rambam, Ela b'chazaka, it was just a legal presence there. It wasn't a physical conquest of the land. Ulefikach, and therefore, kol mokem, and this becomes relevant today, kol mokem shehechziku ba'oli babel, all the places that the second temple aliyah got to, the nitkadesh b'kedushas Ezra, they got this kedusha of Ezra, Hashnia, the second kedusha, huma kedush hayom, that's what remains today. Whatever kedusha there was today, it's only in the places that Ezra got to, which is not the entire Eretz Israel. Meaning, when Yahushua came in and gave it the full sanctity at the beginning for the first temple, even before the first temple, they conquered the whole thing from the very top to the very bottom. When Ezra came back later for the second temple, they just got a slice in the middle. Meaning that there are large parts of the southern part of Eretz Israel, which we now call the Arava, down towards Eilat, which never were taken over again by Ezra in the second, if you like, the second temple period. And therefore they never got that Kedusha at all. The rest got a Kedusha, but what is that Kedusha? So he says, let's carry on. Where am I? Sheikhziku Balifika, Komaka Sheikhziku Ba'oli Babel, Vinis Kadish Bekedusha, Ezra Hashnia, Huma Kudish Hayom, the Afal Pisha Nilka Ka'aris Menu, but nevertheless, even though the land was taken in the second time, it's only chayiv in shvius like it's chayiv in truma. And in number 11, which I'm not going to go into now because I don't have time to do it all, the Rambam clearly says that today truma is also drabonon. Why? Because not all the Jewish people came back. So there are multiple levels to this. It seems, according to most poskim, that there are two very good reasons why Shemitah today is rabbinic and not min haTorah. Number one, it's linked with Yovel, and since there is no Yovel today because Yovel only applies on all the Jewish people living in their tribe, and they're not, therefore there is no Shemitah on a Torah level, only the rabbinic, on a rabbinic level. And secondly, the status of Shemitah tracks the status of Truma. And Truma only has the Kedusha because of Ezra that came back, And that Kedusha was partial. It wasn't a full conquest. It was only a possession. It was only part of the land. And it's only itself rabbinic in nature. And since Shemitah tracks Truma, and Truma is rabbinic as well, so Shemitah is rabbinic too. Now, there is Truma is when you give the first part of the produce that you pick in Eretz Israel, you give it to the Kohen. And then the Maizel, although you do today, you don't give it to the Kohen because the Kohen are Tamei and they can't eat it, but you take it off for the Kohen, Maizel, you should take it off for the Levi, etc. So there are numerous reasons why, according to the majority of posting, and I brought you here on the sheet, how the lineup works. I brought you the Rishonim at the bottom. According to the Rambam, Rashi, Rashba, Ritva, Ran, and others, the Shemitah is rabbinic. According to the Ramban and the Rosh, Shemitah is Doraita. So you have a machlokes on this. But even in the later authorities, in the Achronim, if you flip over the page for a second, in number 3, page 3, I just brought you a list of people. Most of the Achronim, most of the poskim of our day and of the last 300 or 400 years have ruled that Shemitah is rabbinic in nature. And I'm talking about poskim across the Jewish world, including the different communities. Look at the people that I've mentioned here. Some older ones, the Bach, the Sma, the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer is already 19th century. Rav Kook. But also the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish is very much the leading, if you like, position of the Haredi position on Shemitah. That also holds that Shemitah today is rabbinic in nature. Okay, Rav Chaim Ozi Grzinski, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, Rav Avadi Yosef, who passed away just last year. They all took the view that Shemitah was rabbinic. There were some detractors, the Beis HaLevi and the Netziv, and you see some nice pictures. I brought you a lot of pictures today in the sheet so you can get a visual view of who these people are. The Beis HaLevi and the Netziv, who were two very important Lithuanian figures in the Lithuanian world in the 19th century, both in Volozhin, the Beis HaLevi and the Netziv, where the Rosh Yeshiva there, they took the view it was Doraisa, but that is a minority view. And we will see that the major historical controversy of Shemitah is the Heta Mechira. And the Heta Mechira is based on a presumption that Shemitah today is Durabonon. If Shemitah today is not Durabonon, the Heta Mechira does not work. It's based on other presumptions as well, and other halachic issues, but the first and the most foundational one is that Shemitah today is Durabonon. And that's really not that controversial, because pretty much everybody holds that. Although there is a minority position, not like that, because of the link with Truma and because of the link with Yovel. Yeah, a couple of questions. You had a question, Sharon had a question, yeah.
So, according to the two reasons why Shemitah today is Rabbanon, I understand the first one in order, to make this tikkun or whatever for that, Mashiach would have to come, we'd have to understand...
I never said anything about Mashiach. By the way, you mentioned Mashiach.
We'd have to understand, what tribe we're a part of, all move here, and live in that area.
Although I would point out, that's true for Yovel. Yovel needs a higher level, of return. The tribes have to come back, people have to know what tribes they're even from, they have to go back living in the right place. Truma may not. Truma seems to depend on whether the majority of the Jewish people are in Israel or not. Not necessarily the tribes. And therefore, there could come a time, not too long from now, where we overtip into a position where the majority of Jews living in the world are living in Eretz Israel. That's not so impossible. And that might have an impact on this equation as well.
On Truma,
not on Yovel, because Yovel we all have to get back into our tribal units, and that doesn't look as though it's happening anytime soon. And you're right, maybe Mashiach will be needed for that. But the numbers game people are already starting to talk about, and it rather depends on how many Jews from America make Aliyah, how many Jews from Israel have how many babies, how many people assimilate. And it also depends on who is halakhically Jewish, which is an interesting question, because there may be an awful lot of people out there who are halakhically Jewish who don't know they're halakhically Jewish, or vice versa, and that's a complicated question which I'm not getting into now.
But for the second reason, the conquering of the land, so would we have to then leave the land and come back and conquer it?
An interesting question, because kibush ha'aretz, so that kedusha to come back, what does kibush mean? Did the non-Jewish world has given us Eretz Israel, a state in Israel. It's given us permission to have a state in Israel. And we now have, we didn't take Israel by force in the 1948 war. It was given, bits of it we did, and then therefore we can talk about how that relates to the, Yehuda v'Shomron issue. But Medinat Israel as a state was given to us. Is that called a conquest? We now have control over it. We'll see that Medinat Israel impacts on the Shemitah issues. I really want to get into the historical issues, but I'll take a couple of questions and then.
If Shemitah still depends on Yovel. Why don't we have Yovel?
Because the tribes are not living in Israel, and we don't know which tribes we're from, and therefore we don't have Yovel.
But at what point were they just like, okay, no more?
once Reuben and Gad, we're talking long time back, first temple time, once Reuben and Gad left, were taken away, that's it. Already for 2,800 years we have now.
Do you know when Yovel would be?
That's another good question, how we make the count, which is part of the Cheshbon as well, which is not so straightforward. There are different opinions on that. And that also impacts, by the way, on today's Shemitah year. There are slightly different opinions on how you count Shemitah, which can also impact on how strict we're going to be about Shemitah. But I really want to go on, otherwise I won't get to talk about the history, and I've got half an hour now. I gave you a half an hour of Torah, give you a half an hour of history. History is also Torah. Let's get into the controversy and see how it works. Now, historically, Shemitah was not an issue for about 2,000 years. We saw that source in the Gemara that talks about when the Romans had taken over, they had permission to water the land. Is it Shemitah Derabbanan? Is it Shemitah Doraisa? Eventually, the Yishuv in Eretz Israel dissipated. By the 6th or 7th century, there were very few Jews living in Eretz Israel at all. Almost everyone was living in Chutz La'aretz. People slowly started to come back over the years, but there was no real agricultural presence in Eretz Israel until the mid-19th century. If you look at what they call now the old Yishuv, in the 1700s, 1800s, they were mostly small communities living in the four holy cities, which are Yerushalayim, Hebron, Tzfat, and Tiberias. There was very little going on in the fields. Most of it was Arab, and there were very few Arabs here either. Most of it was barren and desolate. I refer you to Mark Twain's famous journey around Israel and what he writes about Israel in the late 1800s, that the place was basically completely barren. There was nothing here. Jews began to come back in what we now call the New Yishuv in the 1870s, 1880s. And I've brought you on page 3 a nice little picture here, a map, which was from this book, which I strongly recommend, of the New Yishuvim, the first 12 Yishuvim, which came about in the late 1800s, and the dates on which they were put together. You'll see from Petach Tikva in 1878 through what we now call the first and the second Aliyah, these new settlements, some of which are now very big towns like Rehovot and Hadera, some of them are still small, like, you know, in Kinneret and Degania and the Kibbutz there, these began to be set up. Almost immediately, people came upon the issue of Shemitah. And what I want you to do is just flip over to page 4, and I'm going to take you through 9 or 10 Shemitah years and talk about the big issues that blew up. And what we'll find is that, in many ways, this is a microcosm of the Jewish world that we see today. Meaning, when you look around you today, in 2014, and there are Haredi communities, and religious Zionist communities, and Hasidic communities, and these ones don't like this, and these ones don't like that, and they're fighting about this, and they're agreeing on that, etc. Those issues didn't just spring up out of nowhere in 2014. They came about gradually over time, and one of the flashpoints over the last 140 years that has contributed to the situation we live in today have been the Shemitah years on a regular basis. And hopefully you'll begin to see how, really right up until today, these communities are approaching it in different ways. Now, the first Shemitah I want to talk about is 1874-5. There wasn't really anybody here yet in the agricultural areas. It was pre-settlement. There was a school called Mikveh Yisrael, which was an agricultural school, which was experimental. It was set up to see if we could grow anything here, b'chlal. Really, Shemitah was not kept at all. They were not religious. There were some rabbis began to say at the time, well, what's going on with Shemitah? These people are now living here. They're farming a little bit. Should they be keeping Shemitah? But they didn't really take any notice, and Shemitah was basically ignored. However, the next Shemitah year, 1881-2, there was already a settlement, which was Petach Tikva. Petach Tikva was set up, is what the first Aliyah, by religious Jews. The first Aliyah was mostly religious Jews. And they wanted to keep Halacha. And therefore there was a question as to what to do with Shemitah. In the end, the malaria that was rampant around the Petach Tikva area, if anyone's been to Petach Tikva now, it doesn't feel like a malaria swamp anymore. Okay? You know, you drive up from the Ben Gurion airport and you're in Petach Tikva and it's like high rise everything. If you can imagine, just take away all the buildings, it's a bit like imagining Manhattan in 1700, you know, before anything was there. So it was a malaria swamp, and the truth is most of the people left before Shemitah, they founded the nearby town of Yehud, which is just around there. Those who stayed mostly followed the psak of Rav Shmuel Salant. Rav Shmuel Salant is a very important individual. We'll see a photo of him in a minute. He was the Rav of the old Yishuv. He was already quite old by this time. He lived a very, very long time. And he gave them a psak and he said, that's it, Shemitah year, you cannot sow the land, you cannot work the land, you have to leave it fallow. So those that remained basically kept Shemitah. Of course, this was extremely difficult because there was almost nothing there in the first place, and leaving the whole thing for a year was almost the death of the Yishuv. But they kept it, they didn't carry out any work, and at the time, the secular new Yishuv, Eliezer ben Yehuda, who was famous for founding Hebrew, was actually quite in favor of this at the time because he thought this would help make the old Yishuv people a bit more nationalistic, that Shemitah was going to be a nationalist clarion call, if you like, and therefore he supported that. The next Shemitah year was really where it all blew up, and this is the subject of this book by Finkel that I mentioned before, because by the next year, Shemitah year, 1888-9, a lot of stuff had happened in the meantime. What had happened? A few important things. First of all, 1882, there was a massive crackdown in Russia, something called the May Laws, where the Russian government restricted Jewish settlements, something called the Pale of Settlement. And therefore there was mass deportation around in Russia. Jews were thrown out of their homes. There were pogroms of a very increasing scale. Therefore, a lot of Jews in Russia were beginning to feel there is no future for us here, and we have to move. And there was a movement called Chovevei Tzion that was founded in 1882. Chovevei Tzion, the lovers of Zion, was a movement founded by secular but attracted also religious people living in Russia. And Chovevei Tzion, if you like, was really the beginning of the flowering of what we today call religious Zionism. There were a few important rabbis you need to know about. One of them was Rav Shmuel Moylever. If you look over to page 5 for a second, you'll see a picture of him on the bottom. I'm going to get you to flick around a little bit here. Rav Shmuel Moylever was one of the leaders of Chovevei Tzion, and it was a kind of uneasy partnership between him as a Rav, who was very religiously Zionistic in motive. There was no such thing as Zionism yet. This is before Herzl. This is before anyone had really coined the phrase. I don't think even the phrase anti-Semitism had been coined yet. But he was one of the beginners of the idea that there could be a religious part of this moving back to Eretz Israel. It had a religious flavor as well as a nationalistic one. And in fact, part of Chovevei Tzion broke away to be a religious sector, which they called Mizrahi. And if you've heard the expression Mizrahi, this is where it comes from. Mizrahi was an acronym for Merkaz Ruchani. It doesn't mean Eastern only. It also means Eastern. But it means Merkaz Ruchani, meaning that we want Israel to be a spiritual home, not just a nationalistic home. And therefore Chovevei Tzion really got going. And they encouraged the settlement of the land. If you flip back to the page before, there was a very important partnership made between Rabbi Moylever and Baron de Rothschild. If you saw his picture, he's a very important player. Baron Edmund de Rothschild, who himself was not a religious Jew as such, but he was not really a secular Jew either. He was very committed to the Jewish people, very strongly committed to the Jewish people. And of course he had a fortune of money, part of the Rothschild banking family. And therefore Rabbi Moylever convinced Baron Rothschild to invest heavily in a number of settlements, including these early settlements in Maskeret, Batya Ekron. When they hit on 1888, which is Shemitah year, Baron Rothschild had a problem. If you think about it, he just poured a fortune of money into these settlements over the last 8 years, and now these religious farmers came to him and said, aha, well, there's this thing called Shemitah, and we now need to do nothing on the land for an entire year. So Baron Rothschild was obviously a bit unhappy with this, and he sent a delegation to Rav Shmuel Salant in the old Yishuv and said to him, look, what can we do about this? Come on, you're a rabbi, come up with some out-of-the-box rabbinic solutions. Rav Shmuel Salant basically sent him home and said, there's nothing that can be done, the land can't be worked, it has to lie fallow. And Baron Rothschild was very unhappy. And when Baron Rothschild is unhappy, people start moving. Why was he unhappy? A number of reasons. He was unhappy because of the money. He was going to have to bail out all of these farmers. He was unhappy because everyone had tried to convince him it would never work to settle. He was fanatically committed to settling Eretz Israel. And everyone else had said to him, you're nuts. It'll never work, because for various reasons it'll never take off, and he didn't want to be proved wrong. He also had a philosophy on Judaism that he felt that, you know, there was a way forward. Judaism is going to stop us from living a normal life. He also wanted to break away from the old dependency model of the old yeshuv. You know, the old yeshuv which existed on handouts from Chutz La'aretz. That the religious rabbis go around the world collecting money and we support you. He said, no, there has to be some self-independence. And he also didn't want to be taken for a ride. He thought these religious farmers, chutzpahdik farmers, are telling him, we'll take all your money and then we'll sit and do nothing for a whole year on your money. So he turned around to his rabbi in Paris, Rav Tzadok Khan, and said to him, look, I can't get anywhere with Rav Shmuel Salant in the old city. Can you come up with a solution? So Rav Tzadok Khan went to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Now, a lot of people mistakenly say that Rav Kook invented the Hefer Mechira, and that is not correct. I've seen that so many times in newspaper articles by Hidra and Shurim. It is not correct. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector was one of the major gedolim in Europe, in Lithuania. I didn't actually put a picture of him in here. I should have done, because it's important that you see who he is. And he came up with the idea of the Hefer Mechira. The Hefer Mechira, he said, works like this. He based it off of a tshuva from the 17th century, where there was an old tshuva. In fact, he was so intent on finding this tshuva, he sent someone from Lithuania to Berlin to pick up a copy of the tshuva and bring it back to Lithuania, because it didn't exist in Lithuania. An old tshuva where somebody sold a vineyard in Eretz Israel for 2 years, and the tshuva was from it's a little known tshuva from Rav Mordechai Robio, the Shemen Amor, that said that was mutter. He could sell his vineyard to a non-Jew for 2 years, and that way it wouldn't be Jewishly owned during Shemitah, and therefore could be worked to some degree during Shemitah. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, based off of this and a number of other things, produced this thing called the Hefer Mechira. The Hefer Mechira basically works like this. The farmer will sell his farm, his land, to a non-Jew for a couple of years, and during that period, the land will be worked. But what kind of work? So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector said, first of all, it has to be sold to a non-Jew. And even then, no malacha d'oraisa can be done on the land, only malacha d'rabbanon. And without getting into all of the details of Hilchos Shemitah, he said you're very restricted. You can't plant things, you can maybe do a little bit of watering here and there, etc. You can't plant anything, and you can't do malacha d'oraisa. And then he toughened it up even more and said, actually, I don't want you to do any work on the land, only non-Jews can work on the land. Meaning, in the end, the Hefer Mechira came out, which was Rabbi Yitzchak Spector, that the land had to be owned by a non-Jew and worked by a non-Jew, and after the 2 year period, it could be sold back to the Jew, so at least the land wouldn't be destroyed and the agricultural settlements wouldn't be ended. Now, in order for the Hefer Mechira to work, it relies on a number of halachic assumptions, which I'm not going to get into now. What I did at the back of your little booklet is I gave you, which I'm not even going to get into today, from page 15 through page 19 is a long, although abbreviated because it's a complex issue, analysis of whether the Hefer Mechira works or doesn't work. And I've brought you 12 issues, which come up in the Hefer Mechira, and the pros and the cons. Meaning, I've tried to be even-handed, hopefully even-minded as well, whatever that means. I've tried to put you the arguments for, the arguments against, and not take any sides. But the Hefer Mechira relies on a lot of halakhic issues, and they all have to stack in order for the Hefer Mechira to work. The three main ones are A, that the Shemitah status is rabbinic, not Doraisa, like we talked about at the beginning. B, that it actually works to sell Eretz Israel to a non-Jew, which is not so clear, because there is a halachic prohibition of selling the land of Israel to a non-Jew. And how are we going to deal with that? Because it seems that you jumped out of the frying pan into the fire. You've dealt with the Shemitah issue, maybe, okay, but you've then done the serious Aveira of selling Eretz Israel, or bits of Eretz Israel, not the whole of Eretz Israel, it's the individual farms to a non-Jew. How do you deal with that? And again, there are answers to all of these questions. And the third issue is whether it even works to remove the sanctity of the land if you do succeed in selling it to a non-Jew. Because there's a whole halakhic debate that even if I do sell the land to a non-Jew, and it is somehow permitted to sell land to a non-Jew, does that in any way release it from its obligations of Shemitah? Or is it still effectively Eretz Israel and the whole thing has just been fruitless? No pun intended. Okay. So these three issues and many, many more issues come up with the Hefer Mechira. But Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector was a very major gadol. The whole of why you bet midrash is called Rietz. Rietz, R-I-E-T-S. which is the Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary. YU is named after Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Okay? He was a very major gadolim. No one could argue that he was one of the major gadolim. He came up with a hetzer mechira and said, this works. Now, Baron de Rothschild was delighted because he took this hetzer mechira, he waved it in the face of all his farmers on his settlements, and he said, look, this is good enough for him, this is good enough for you. Please will you do what he said and keep the hetzer mechira. The hetzer mechira was opposed by a number of other Lithuanian rabbis, the Netziv, the Beis Halevi that we mentioned before, who hold that it's Doraisa anyway, that they didn't even start. But other ones as well, Rabbi Eliezer Gordon, the Aruch HaShulchan as well. A number of people didn't like it at the time. There was also another parallel Hetzer Mechira, which I'm not really getting into the whole details, by three important Rabbanim who produced their own Hetzer Mechira, which was similar to Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector's, but were a bit more lenient, but they said it depended on him, and you can read about it in the sheet that I put in there. But basically, you ended up now with two camps. Baron de Rothschild and those who supported the Hetzer Mechira, and the old Yishuv who reacted very negatively. The old Yishuv, Rav Shmuel Salant and others, were very unhappy. Why? Because they said, look, they felt they'd been very let down by Baron de Rothschild, and they felt that this was the creeping influence of the secular Zionists influencing the new Yishuv. And they were suspicious of people like Rabbi Moaliver, who was this new kind of halfway breed. He was religious, and yet he was Zionist. And how does that work? What is that exactly? And Ada Yom Hazeh, until this very day, there's a very interesting relationship between the Haredi community, the secular community, and the religious Zionist community. Because to some degree, and this is just my personal take on this, the Haredi community knows how to deal with the secular community. Because it's clear, these people are secular, these people are religious. And there's like old precedent to deal with this. But how does the Haredi community deal with the religious Zionist community? Because you can't say these people are secular, but on the other hand, they stand for a whole bunch of principles that the Haredi community does not agree with. And therefore, is that on a certain level even worse than being secular? Because you think you're religious and you're not even religious, and et cetera, et cetera. Therefore, this is a tension that began already at this point when there were people supporting the Hetzer Mechira, and people like Eliezer Ben Yehuda came out very favorably in favor of the Hetzer Mechira now, and if you like, the battle lines were drawn. In the end, the farmers divided. Some of them used the Hetzer Mechira, some of them didn't, and it went on from there. Now, that was the big blow up in 1888. The next Shemitah year, 1895-6, things had moved on. What had moved on? Baron de Rothschild was very much more in control. He'd broken the resistance to most of the religious farmers, for all sorts of reasons, which you can read this book and you can see more about it. And actually, in this Hetzer Mechira, in this Shemitah rather, the old Yishuv Rabbonim were more flexible when it came to the Hetzer Mechira. And even though people denied it, that one of the issues, just in general, is, which, depending on which book or which article or which account you read of the history of this, people usually paint it one way or the other. Because the reality is, everybody was very conflicted throughout this whole process. Nobody was ever totally happy with any of the solutions. And therefore you end up with people saying slightly contradictory things or unclear things, and of course everybody today tries to kind of paint them clearly into this way or to this way, but the reality is they were never clear at the time, because people felt very torn at the time. And therefore here in this next Shemitah, even the old Yishuv Rabbanim began to be a little bit more in favour of the Hetzer Mechira. On certain conditions, they changed it a little bit, but there was a little bit more flexibility. I'm actually going to go on, because otherwise I'm never going to get to where I need to get to by 20 past 10. And I brought you here Rav Shmuel Salant's picture, Rav Yeshua Lev Diskin, who was very important in the old Yishuv at this time. And you can read there, they made a few technical changes. They sold the trees rather than the land. And they said, look, we can live with this a little bit. Because let's not forget, at the time, if you were to insist, by 1895 there were a lot of settlements. If you were to insist that all of them do nothing for an entire year, then that's already going to be a very serious issue, potentially even pikuach nefesh, and certainly very major financial distress. And therefore there was a little bit more flexibility. I'm not going to take any questions, I'm really sorry, because I don't want to get caught. I'll take questions at the end if I have time. Okay? Fine. Let's go forward to 1903. 1903, a few things have changed. You had a new person on the block, who was the Aderet. The Aderet was actually Rav Kook's father-in-law. Interestingly, although not a lot of people know this or say this, Rav Kook himself and the Adarid, when they were still living in Russia in the early days, were quite against the Heter Mechira. Later, when they came to Eretz Yisrael, they were persuaded more in favor, and we'll talk about Rav Kook in a few minutes. But by 1903, where Rav Diskinder passed away, Rav Shmuel Salam was very old, the Adarid was reluctantly persuaded to agree to the Heter Mechira on the same kind of lines that they permitted back in 1895, and therefore they kind of worked along on that basis. But the real flashpoint issue was the next Shemitah. Go on to page 7, please. There's a nice picture of the Adarid. By the next Shemitah, you had some very important new figures around. By 1910, Rav Kook was in town. Rav Kook was the chief rabbi of Yafo. He wasn't yet the chief rabbi of Israel. He was the chief rabbi of Yafo. And there was someone else in Sfat called the Ritvaz, Rav Yaakov David Wilowski, and there are pictures of them on the next page as well. And the second Aliyah was now well underway. There's a lot of Jewish settlements in Eretz Israel, and a lot of it's very secular. Because the second Aliyah was mostly non-religious people. And therefore you have a whole different situation by 1910, where there's a lot of people who are just going to ignore Shemitah, and they're not really interested in asking Shailas at all. Came along Rav Kook, and he said, look, Baron Rothschild was still there, and there was a whole attempt to try and persuade Rav Kook to abandon the Heter Mechira. And Rav Kook said, you know something? No. The Heter Mechira was made by Rav Yitzchak HaKonitz Spector. It's established, it has some of the support of some of the leading lights of the 19th century Lithuania. And therefore he insisted that we keep the Heter Mechira. Again, they made a few changes here and a few changes there, but they kept the Heter Mechira. But Rav Kook was at pains to say, look, I don't like this. It works. He says very clearly it works. But I don't like it. Every Shemitah year we have to re-examine it. And if we can find any alternative solutions, then we should. But for now, we'll go with the Heter Mechira. We'll support farmers who don't want to use the Heter Mechira, but that's secondary. Now, the Ritvaz was very unhappy with this. And really, it's at this point that the battle lines were completely drawn between those who were supported and those who were against. The old Yishuv, which we now call the Haredi community, wasn't called that then, but the old Yishuv from this point on basically was completely against the Heter Mechira, and Rav Kook and the new Yishuv were in favour of the Heter Mechira. However, Rav Kook, throughout the whole of his life, was always torn in two directions, and he ended up being fired on by everybody. The old Yishuv said, how can you support these secular people? You're working with the secular, you know, destroyers of Judaism, and the Heter Mechira doesn't work. The new Yishuv, the secular Jews, turned around to Rav Kook and said to him, you're being too strict on us, you're not being lenient enough, and you're, at the end of the day, secretly, you know, connected with the old Yishuv as well, and therefore you're not really on our side. And so Rav Kook, if you read Rav Kook's biography, there's a very good biography of Rav Kook by someone called Yehuda Mirsky, I can't remember the name of it. Just put Rav Kook Mirsky into a Google search, and you'll get it now. It talks about how Rav Kook was very torn between left and right, between secular and religious, the whole of his life, and he tries to steer this path. He did come up with another idea in 1910, which is called Oitzer Beis Din. And this was the first time that Oitzer Beis Din was raised. What is Oitzer Beis Din? Oitzer Beis Din is based on classical sources, although not many, which is one of the problems with it. It's based on sources, and it basically says like this. If the farmers want to make a collective, meaning they sell their land effectively to the Beis Din, and the Beis Din controls the land, it's not under individual ownership, and the farmers don't get paid by the crop, they get paid a fixed amount for their labour, for their time, etc., and they're effectively agents of the Beis Din, then, based on the sources which we're not going to see now, Oitzer Beis Din will allow them to pick the crop, it won't allow them to work the land. Oitzer Beis Din does not allow planting, it allows you to harvest and to sell, and this will be a way that they can actually do something with the harvest. It doesn't solve all the problems, but Rav Kook suggested it, and it was taken up by some people. We don't know exactly how successful it was. It probably wasn't that widespread at the time, but Oitzer Beis Din made its appearance there. But Rav Kook himself, as I said, only permitted work by non-Jews, or rabbinic work by Jews, if absolutely necessary, and it was an unhappy compromise, and he himself felt conflicted. There's a wonderful article, by the way, that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, when he made Aliyah, when he came to Israel, he's the Rosh Hashiva of the Gush of Haaretzion, he wrote an article in 1973 about how distressed he was at Shemitah, that every solution is partial and leaves you feeling very if you like, in exile almost, that we can't really deal with any of these issues properly. And for Shemitah is a wonderful opportunity to experience like halachic angst. Maybe not on a practical level, but on a theoretical level, that all of these solutions, you know, get part of the way to the solution, but don't really deal with it completely. Let's go on. Some nice pictures of the relevant people. There's gentleman on the left with an extremely nice strimal, is Rav Chaim Berlin, who was the son of the Netziv, who was one of the important players in the old yeshiva at the time. He was in favour of the Oitzer Beis Din, but not in favour of the Hetzer Mechira. We have Rav Kook in the middle. I brought you a slightly less used picture of Rav Kook because I thought I like this picture, and I think it times it from when he was actually that age. And the Ritvaz, who was the other one, the other Rav from Svat that I mentioned, and they each wrote Svarim. Rav Kook wrote a very important sefer called Shabbat HaAretz, which sets out his position, and if you want to study in depth, this is what you end up studying. Now, next Shemitah, 1917, First World War, even more pressure. The Ottomans insisted, because they were in the war effort, the Ottomans insisted that the Jews have to plough the land, and then the British invaded in the middle of Shemitah year. General Allenby, okay, invaded Israel in 1917, and took back in November, just after the Shemitah year, took Eretz Israel for the British, and the British mandate started. Gain Rav Kook, who was actually stuck in England, of all terrible places to be stuck, for years. He got stuck for most of the First World War in Switzerland, which is quite nice actually in Switzerland, but then he ended up in London as a Rav, but he strongly supported the Hetzer Mechira from London, but he wasn't Eretz Yisrael. Now, fast forward another 7 years, 1924, Rav Kook is back in town big time, because now he's the chief rabbi of the whole of Israel, and he continued to support the Hetzer Mechira. The old Yishuv continued to oppose it, and that really carried on as it was. 1931 didn't really have any major changes. Rav Kook, it was Rav Kook's last Shemitah. He died in 1935. But by 1937-8, there was a very important new person in town who was the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish, Rav Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, arrived in Eretz Israel in 1933. He almost immediately began campaigning on the issue of Shemitah, and he was very against the Hetzer Mechira on many grounds. However, don't make the mistake of thinking, as some people think, that he was strict and Rav Kook was lenient. Rav Kook was actually very strict in Hilchos Shemitah on many issues, and Rav Rimon goes through many issues on which Rav Kook was very machmir, and the Chazon Ish personally was very lenient, and those leniencies actually allowed the Chazon Ish to work without the Hetzer Mechira. Rav Kook's stringencies required almost the Hetzer Mechira, otherwise there's nothing to be done, and you can read more in Rav Rimon's book on that. But the Chazon Ish became very much the leader and the founder in many ways of what we today call Haredi Judaism, Haredi society in Eretz Israel. And he very clearly worked with farmers that wanted to not work the land at all. He set up this thing called Keren HaShemitah, which supported farmers who were not working the land at all. And he very much opposed the Hetzer Mechira. Fine. 1948-5, no major changes, although the Chazon Ish pushed the Oitzer Beis Din. But by 1951, there were some very major changes, because now there was a State of Israel. And the State of Israel changes things, halachically as well, and you can look at the stuff at the back that I put at the back, because can you now argue, if you sell the land to a non-Jew, that it really is non-Jewish control? Because at the end of the day, the State of Israel controls everything now. And therefore, all the halachic issues were reassessed. The new chief rabbi of the new state of Israel, well, he wasn't new because he took over from Rav Kook in the 30s, was Rav Herzog. Here's a beautiful picture of Rav Herzog, Rav Isaac Herzog, who actually grew up where I grew up, although that's all I have in common with him, really. I suppose we have a little bit more in common, but I would aspire to have more in common. He grew up in Leeds, and he lived many years in Ireland. He was the chief rabbi of Ireland. He actually wrote his PhD thesis on the Tcheles, which is not for now, which is another topic entirely, but he became the chief rabbi of Israel, and at the beginning he was also very conflicted. He wanted to try and get rid of the Hetzer Mechira and replace it with something else. In the end he was convinced not to, and he came up with this statement here in the box in number 9, on page 9, supporting the Hetzer Mechira, and again the battle lines were pretty much drawn, and I'm going to skip all of the Shemitahs from 1952 all the way to the last Shemitah year. And this is where I want to pick up on some of the modern issues that lead on from this. Shemitah 2007. The Manning family were already in Israel, although that's not very historically relevant. But it is to me. Things began to change already before this, but things began to change significantly in 2007. What began to change? First of all, the chief rabbinate which is the Zionist body of religious Judaism in Israel, began, and it didn't start then, it started before, has began to become less and less excited by the Heter Mechira, and more inclined to try and move towards what we might call a more Haredi position, which is to oppose the Heter Mechira. And this caused a lot of friction back in 2007, because what the chief rabbinate did is they gave permission to local Batei Din around Israel, local Rabbaniyot, to make their own decisions on whether yes or not to support the Heter Mechira. And this caused a lot of difficult feeling, bad feeling, because there were a number of local rabbinates who actually said, we're not going to go with Heter Mechira at all. And we're not talking about the old Yishuv, quote unquote, the Haredi community, we're talking about the chief rabbinate. And there were a lot of people that said, well, this undermines the Heter Mechira, and we still need the Heter Mechira. I know people say that these days it's not the same as it was in 1880. That's true. But there's a massive financial investment in agriculture in this country still. And also there are many people from the Arab side who are trying to buy up Jewish land in this country and remove the Jewish presence in farming in this country. And therefore there are many people who feel that the Heter Mechira is still extremely important and very relevant, and you can look at the arguments in the back, and people were very unhappy with this perceived move away from the classic chief rabbinic position in favour of the Heter Mechira. Also at the same time, if you think historically, this was just after the whole Gush Katif thing. Therefore, there were many people in the religious Zionist community who were very traumatized by the Gush Katif experience. Gush Katif was the Jewish settlement in Gaza, which was removed as part of the whole political unilateral evacuation of Gaza in 2005. And one of the things that 2008 Shemitah saw was a real growth of this new idea of Otzer Beis Din being a really serious option. And this also is connected with Gush Katif. I brought you two very interesting articles, which clearly we're not going to read now. I brought you an article in 2007 from the Jerusalem Post, on page 10. I brought you an article from Haaretz. I don't often get to bring articles from Haaretz. And, you know, it's written by Haaretz reporters, so I can't personally agree with every single thing he writes in that. But it gives you a very interesting overview of how the different communities are moving in different directions. Meaning, there are people in the religious Zionist community who are moving away from Heter Mechira, for all sorts of reasons, and in favour of this other option of Otzer Beis Din. And there are other people in the religious Zionist community who feel this is undermining a lot of the Zionist foundations of the religious Zionist community, because Heter Mechira is a very important part of the whole, you know, the patchwork of different options in Shemitah, which supports the regular farmers and the people who need it. And I really recommend that you read those articles. It gives you a little bit of a feel for what's going on. So how does that affect Shemitah today? So let's just have 3 or 4 minutes on Shemitah, this Shemitah. So first of all, turn to page 12. A few new things have been going on this Shemitah. First of all, every single Shemitah year, the Rabbanut tries to tighten up the provisions of the Heter Mechira. They make it even more binding, make sure that people have more of a clear understanding that it's a real sale, it's not a fictional sale. This year, for the first time, they're not selling the land to an Arab. They're selling it to a Ger Toshav. A Ger Toshav is a non-Jew who accepts the 7 Noahide laws. It's a Ukrainian guy whose grandfather is Jewish, who is not himself Jewish. His father's father's Jewish. And he, maybe even his mother's father's Jewish. One of his grandfathers is Jewish. He's not Jewish. He came to Israel under the law of return. He's allowed to come in. He has a Jewish grandparent. And the Rabbanut this year has sold the land to him, because that tightens up the halachic validity of the sale, because it's less problematic saying to a Ger Toshav. But it's not so straightforward, because can you even have a Ger Toshav today? Is that relevant? Maybe that also depends on other things that we don't have today. Look at the back of the sheet and you'll see how the other responds. But that's one thing they did. The Rabbanut is also becoming less excited about the Heter Mechira this time around. If you look at the Jerusalem Rabbanuts, and I did a bit of research and I spoke to quite a lot of people about this, the Mahadrin Heksha of the Jerusalem Rabbanut does not rely on Heter Mechira at all. They have something called Shmita Kehilchata, which is a funny way of saying it because it sounds like the other one is not Kehilchata, but it is, it just relies on the Heter Mechira. But Shmita Kehilchata, and you can read the sheet, you see exactly, I went through exactly what they do, what they don't do, but again, it's all part of this issue of trying to pull away from the Heter Mechira a little bit, which again some in the religious Zionist community are really not happy about. And there are multiple levels of Rabbanut Heksha, this Shemitah round. Some of them do use the Hetzer Mechira, some of them don't. I brought you on page 13 I know it's not going to be helpful because it's all in Hebrew, but at some stage you can go through this with somebody. The different kinds of Rabbanut Hesher, this was taken from the Shuk, which appear right now, and you'll see that some Rabbanut Hesher's do rely on Hetzer Mechira, some do not rely on Hetzer Mechira, because it's all part of this process of trying to somehow disconnect. Another very interesting thing that happened this year for the first time that my son pointed out to me is the Israeli army had a massive change of policy. Up until now, the Israeli army has completely relied on the Hetzer Mechira. I mean, why not? They are part of the Israeli system, and the Hetzer Mechira is built into that system. This year, the rabbinate of the army said, we don't want to rely on the Hetzer Mechira. We want to use Eitzah Beis Din. Why? Part of it is the unhappiness with Hetzer Mechira generally, even in the religious Zionist community. Part of it is the Haredi influence coming into the army. Because you have a lot of Haredi soldiers who will turn around and say, well, I'm not going to eat this stuff. We don't rely on Hetzer Mechira because the old Yeshuvim, the Haredi poskim, do not accept it for good reasons that you'll see in the back of the sheet. Therefore, the army turned around and said, fine, so we won't use Hetzer Mechira at the beginning of the year. The beginning of the year, we'll use Eitzah Beis Din. At the end of the year, when we have no choice, we'll use Hetzer Mechira. So the agriculture sector took the army to court and said, you can't do this. We rely on the Hetzer Mechira. What are our farmers going to do? So the army turned around to them and said, well, why didn't you sign up for Eitzah Beis Din? And they said, well, we didn't know you were going to use Eitzah Beis Din. And they went to court, and the army won in court. And they are attacking using the Eitzah Beis Din at the beginning of the year, which could have a massive impact on next Shemitah year, because now in advance, if the farmers know in advance that the army and big contractors like the army are going to use Eitzah Beis Din, so whereas this Shemitah year, only a few hundred farmers are signed up for Eitzah Beis Din, and many thousands for Hetzer Mechira, that might start to flip in the next Shemitah if they feel that big people like the army are switching over to the Eitzah Beis Din system. But you see, this is moving. There's a lot of movement going on within the Israeli society. I was sitting last night with my son in the Gush, right next to the guy in the army who was sitting in the Beit Midrash next to me, who is responsible for setting army halachic policy. Okay? Oh, and then that raises all the questions of Kedusha Shvius, which is, how are we going to deal with that, and is that a problem? And then you start having to come up with, well, how serious is Kedusha Shvius, and are there any heteri within Kedusha Shvius, and which is, again, it's all weighing the options. There's no safe option. I brought you on page 14, and I'll just finish off and tell you what else I brought you. I brought you at the top of the page the statement by the Rabbanei Tzohar. The Rabbanei Tzohar are a group of very distinguished religious Zionist Rabbanim who want to try and make the rabbinate more user-friendly. I wouldn't say they're left-wing, that's certainly not the right way to put it. There's another group called Bet Hillel, which is more of a left-wing leaning thing. But the Rabbanei Tzohar are trying to reach out to the masses and make the interface with the rabbanut in all areas something which secular people find friendly and helpful, which is something to talk about another time. They came out with a policy which they say they support Eitzah Beis Din, again, these are religious rabbis, but they don't want to undermine Hetzer Mechira. And they won't support Eitzah Beis Din at the expense of Hetzer Mechira, because Hetzer Mechira has a very important part to play in the halachic system of the way the Shemitah works. And again, no one should think for one minute that Hetzer Mechira is not a reliable Hetzer. It is supported by some of the greatest halachic minds of the last 200 years, but opposed by equally great halachic minds. So the Zohar rabbis want to support that. This little picture of him can show him Shemitah. You see this around Israel. So who are these guys? So these are the guys who are not doing anything on the fields, who are supporting the Haredi position and are letting the fields lie fallow. So these are not the Hetzer Mechira guys, and these are not the Eitzah Beis Din guys. These are the other guys who are supporting this Keren Hashviyot, etc., etc. Therefore, you know, and I brought you some references to websites that you can go on and look at all about. So what do we have now? Bottom line, to conclude, what we have now basically is three positions in this country. We have the Haredi position, which is very clearly against Hetzer Mechira, okay, which hasn't really changed. Is that me? Sorry. Oh, can't get it. We've got the Haredi position, which is clearly against Hetzer Mechira, which hasn't changed significantly. We have the religious Zionist position, which is still in favour of Heter Mechira, which is changing significantly and moving as time goes on. And we have this Ota Beis Din phenomenon, which is now growing and growing and growing, and more of an awareness of maybe a middle ground that you can engage with Hilchos Shmita, because Ota Beis Din is also supported to some degree by the Haredi community. They're a little bit suspicious, what is this Kedusha Shvius and how does that work, etc. But once you begin to get people less scared, and you begin to get people to actually engage in the positive opportunities of Shmita, like I said at the beginning, then it begins to be more of a real option for people. And therefore, there's much more in this sheet than I've had a chance to say. But hopefully that gives you a little bit of background historically as to how we got to where we got to. I strongly advise you to read the other stuff if that's of interest to you. And I'd certainly be happy to answer questions, but I need to run because I need to be somewhere at 11 o'clock at the other side of town. So I apologize that I wasn't really able to take proper questions today. I like taking questions, but we would never have got through it. And we'll leave it there because you have a lot of other very interesting speakers to listen to. And I'll leave.